jhana states of mind. That's how it works. And everyone understands concentration to some degree. If we didn't have concentration, we wouldn't be able to really achieve our goals in life. We need some concentration. I think everyone's becoming extremely skilled at concentrating on their iPhones, aren't you? Yeah, when you're on your iPhone, you're not aware of anything. Someone can say, "Tuss, tuss, come and do this." Oh, shut up, I'm doing this. This is concentration. And even the Tibetan, Burmese, Thai monks and nuns are all running around now with iPhones. And I fear for the enlightenment of the world now because of iPhones. everyone will be developing a lot of concentration. But it's actually wrong concentration, not right concentration. It's taught by the Buddha, right? It's a concentration that's involved with greed, hatred and delusion, you know, because it produces a lot of craving in the mind, a lot of delusion in the mind. I mean, I'm as bad as anyone, you know, so I'm saying this to remind myself, throw away that iPhone or you won't get enlightened. Because you'll be stuck in this space. So concentration was 2,600 years ago, and not only 2,600 years ago. Even this current age, going through all the religious traditions, they all have some form of concentration meditation. It's only Buddhism, only what the Buddha taught, that produced insight meditation. Vipassana meditation, which can break the shackles, cut the cycle of greed, hatred and delusion, and bring us out of our problems and troubles into a genuine freedom. And this is what the Buddha discovered as he sat underneath the Bodhi tree on the full moon night of May 2600 years ago. It's quite a remarkable story when you think about it. And I feel as though if we're dedicated practitioners, you know, interested in our own minds, interested in seeing how the mind works, and understanding that if we practice what the Buddha taught, that we too, like the Buddha, can come out of this suffering. You know, can come out of the entanglements that bind us. You know, this kind of thing. When you're young, you know, it's very hard to really understand what the Buddha taught, because life is delightful, isn't it? You know, we love sights, sounds, tastes, smells, thoughts, experiences. You know, we want them. We want to experience more, and so one should. It's not to say one has to renounce the world, although a lot of people do this in Asia. I myself became a monk at 23 after a wild youth, you know, I have to say. But suddenly, you know, I started to practice meditation at a Thai temple in London. A friend took me to this temple, and I practiced with this very experienced meditation teacher who taught Vipassana meditation. Every Wednesday night I went for a year, and the first few nights I went there was quite unusual for me. I mean, even though I travelled through Asia for a year or so before doing this, going into a temple in London which was set up like a Thai temple with all the like Buddha rupas, etc., etc., the monks were there. I'm going, wow, where am I, man? This is amazing, you know. And I started to practice his technique that he was teaching, which was this Mahasi Sayadaw, very famous Burmese monk, and the method he taught, this Vipassana. And I could suddenly feel a real shift in how my attitude was to things. You know, within a month or so, the mind started to change a lot, you know, and didn't have that same interest anymore in the things that I used to like going to the pub, doing all the things in flower power days you used to do, you know. And I dropped it all. It all just went away. I had no interest anymore. The mind changes. And it's like, as you grow up and mature, the things that were interesting for you right now are not interesting anymore. You know, you don't have the same craving for those things. And meditation changes you quite, it transforms the personality, actually, quite a lot. As you start to explore the mind more and start to see what's useful for us. You know, what brings happiness to the mind? What brings real happiness to the mind? Right? It's more that I'd like to talk about. You know, that's what I'd like to inspire you to think about. You know, what brings real happiness into the mind? And what's useful, what's not useful for you? You know, we're embroiled in entanglements of negative and positive emotions and thoughts. But can we let go of that which is not of use to us? You know, and you can't until you start to look at the mind. It's impossible because the mind is moving so quickly. We can't catch what's in our mind. So the Buddha taught this meditation to give us the ability to see clearly, to come close to the mind. It's somewhat like doing scientific research on the mind. You know, you put the mind on the slide, you focus the microscope, and you can see what's there. You can see the reality of things. So that's what meditation is like. And then the mind shifts from its previous interests to other things, which are much more profound, much more, in fact, interesting for you when you practice. So that's a little brief summary of how meditation unfolds over a period of time. And I think it's worth understanding this. And this is what the Buddha, what I liked when I first came to the teaching of the Buddha was listening, I'm not too sure how to put that, was his sense of discovery. He really wanted to know, you know, what brings about this suffering? You know, how can he come out of the suffering? You know, that's what he was really interested in. And he made a maha effort, a big effort, you know, to go and find out for himself. He wanted direct experience. He didn't know the path, which is why he went to his two teachers and practiced the techniques that were given in those days, which were concentration practices. Discovering then that at the end of all of this, after he became completely proficient, that it wasn't enough. It didn't do it. Right? It didn't free him, his mind from greed, hatred, and delusion. So sitting underneath the Bodhi tree, he used what he'd learned, and this is important, I think. He used the concentration to allow him, the concentration is like focusing of the microscope. It's the fingers focusing the microscope. Without the concentration that he had developed up to a certain point, he would not have been able to switch to vipassana, which means to see clearly. He wouldn't have been able to see what was on the slide. You understand this? So concentration, you can use as a metaphor like the sharpening of the focus on the microscope. That's what concentration does. And this is what the Buddha did. And so he was able to open up to vipassana and understand this mind-body process. He was able to understand the realities of things. Concentration meditation is still on a conceptual level. It's still it hasn't broken free of the concepts that we have about things. It hasn't broken free of our identification with self in regard to things. When we practice concentration, it doesn't bring us to a state of really breaking free of the concepts in the mind. What are these sort of concepts that I'm talking about here? It's to do with I, me, mine, Tuss, Graham, Susie Ann, name, place, country. I'm Chinese, I'm Australian, you're Thai, I'm Chinese Malay. And how many views and opinions are expressed around that concept? I live in Sydney, I've just been in China, just got back the other day. And I had all these concepts about what it was like to be in China. I hadn't been before. But mine was still hooked into the concept, my ideas or views about what it was going to be like. When I got there, it wasn't like that at all. It was erroneous stuff. I got caught up in it, having this particular view about something. So concepts about I, me, mine, name, place, country, man, woman, all of this is just on the conceptual level. It's not actually the reality of things. Vipassana meditation that the Buddha discovered was concerned with breaking away from our ordinary everyday level of understanding about how we are in the world. It's not to say that we don't live in the world with all these concepts. If Tuss went around saying, I'm not Tuss, I'm just mind and body, people would lock him up. But because he's a wonderful Vipassana practitioner, he understands while he's at university that there's still no I, me, mine. Right? You get that? It's just a concept. And you see the ultimate reality. That's what meditation does. It breaks the shackles. So you don't grasp after things so much. You don't identify with things so much. You're able to let go of views and opinions about this and that. And the mind can stay stable. It can stay tranquil within a situation when the storms come. We can be okay in all of this because we understand what the Buddha was talking about. Vipassana meditation, on the other hand, reveals to us very clearly the central core teachings of the Buddha, which is that it reveals the characteristics of life itself. That everything's changing. You all know this. You've heard this many times, I'm sure. Many teachers have taught you this. This is the Buddha's teachings. Everything changes. Everything's impermanent. Everything is anicca. You never know what's going to happen the next moment. Hard to understand that when you're young and at university. But doesn't everything change? Nothing stays the same, even for a moment. So why do we become attached to it? Because of delusion in the mind. We don't understand. And so the Buddha was trying to teach us to gain wisdom about how things actually are. So we taught in the meditation practice that we can have a clear vision or clear seeing of the universal characteristics of how life is, how this human existence is, how all existence is. Everything changes, nothing stays the same. Anicca, dukkha, seeing the unsatisfactory nature of life itself in actual fact, if we cling to it, if we cling and grasp the things. We think that especially when we're younger, but even in us old senior citizens like myself, we still think things are really rosy, and okay. I'm walking around China, I could hardly move my legs. I'm climbing up the Great Wall, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm not 21 anymore, you know? Dukkha. Dukkha, unsatisfactory. And then the mind would go, oh, fine, maybe I should get, go to the orthopedic surgeon, get new knees, then I'll be good. This kind of thing, dukkha anatta, that there's actually, in reality, just this mind-body process, no Tuss, no Graham, no Susien, no any of you. You know, it's just this mind-body process coming and going, coming and going, coming and going. Which when you start to see this, you'll understand this later with your practice. The attachment to things, the grasping of things, which is what the Buddha talked about, didn't he? It's the central core of his teachings as the maker of suffering. You know, the creator, if you like, of suffering. It's this grasping to things. You start to let go. So while I'm walking up, actually they had a cable car, so I was really happy. You could get a cable car halfway up the Great Wall, and then you'd feel like you were, you know, climbed the top of Mount Everest, but actually you cheated and gone up the cable car. Yeah. It was quite fun. Yeah, it was a little bit scary on the cable car, actually. Yeah. So concepts and reality. That's what this concentration and insight is about. When the Buddha was practicing, they only knew about concentration. So they were still caught up in the imagination of the mind. They would think that they were free when they were having these amazing cosmic experiences. You know, some of these states that are achieved in concentration meditation are beyond comprehension. They're so delightful, so profound, so peaceful, so tranquil. And people would get very attached to those states. But the Buddha, as I mentioned earlier, was not satisfied because he understood that he hadn't finished. He wasn't finished. He still had work to do on himself. So have a lot of gratitude. I was fortunate enough, due to past good karma, I suppose, to be able to take robes in Buddh Gaya, underneath the Bodhi tree. And I didn't really understand what all that meant at that time. I just said, far out, man, this is really trippy, you know. And all these Tibetan monks around, and people going, wow, you know, 20. But now I understand a lot more about how important that is and that place is in the scheme of things. It's really where all of you have come from in some ways, underneath that Bodhi tree. And now you have a strong interest in Buddhism, a strong interest to some degree, at least as yet, in freeing the mind, you know, awakening the mind, I think. And that will probably grow, I hope it does for you in time, and you can practice proficiently and experience what the Buddha was talking about. This would be good. So, we are going to now sit. Does that work? Are you okay with this? Was it clear for you? Yeah? You good? Okay, that's good. When they talk about concentration meditation, they say that the Buddha taught two types of meditation, as I mentioned. You can meditate to develop calm, or you can meditate to develop insight. Or you can use both of them. You can use the concentration, which is what the Buddha did, that he developed, to then develop wisdom or insight by doing vipassana. Now, all the different techniques of vipassana meditation, which I'm going to talk about on November the 7th at the Buddhist Library, there's a lot of different traditions of Vipassana meditation taught in Burma and Thailand, Sri Lanka. A lot of different teachers have different ways of teaching the Satipatthana, or four foundations of mindfulness. I want to talk about this on a talk at the Buddhist Library later on. Concentration is no different. There's 40 different subjects that can be used, or objects that can be used to develop concentration. 40. That's a lot, isn't it? Because in those days people were really interested in concentration meditation. It's actually making a bit of a comeback now. There's a very well-known nowadays Burmese Sayadaw. You know the word Sayadaw? Sayadaw, it's like Ajahn. You know the word Ajahn? You know, the Thai monks, teachers. In Burma, they're called Sayadaws. S-A-Y-D-A-W, Sayadaw. So the monk might be called Sayadaw something, 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 right? Sayadaw Upandita, or Sayadaw Ulakana, or something like that, right? And these Burmese monks are very proficient in both study and practice. You know, I practice a lot with them, and they're really quite exceptional. And in the last number of years, few years, there's been a resurgence in concentration meditation. And one Burmese Sayadaw who speaks English quite well, actually, he's been going to America and Malaysia and teaching concentration to the yogis. Different concentration techniques. What I'd like to do a little meditation now, and then I'd like to talk a little about these subjects of, or objects of meditation we can develop with our concentration meditation. So different techniques, and we might try out a few and just see how that works for you. And then later on we'll shift it to practicing Vipassana. How does that sound? And I'll talk more about the levels of concentration that are required to practice Vipassana successfully. Because in the end, it all comes down to teamwork between concentration and mindfulness, or in actual fact it's the other way around, mindfulness and concentration. When you start to look at the Noble Eightfold Path and you look at the category of meditation, you'll see that it has three arms: effort, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Isn't that so? Yeah. So it's very important in your meditation practice to understand this Noble Eightfold Path and be able to follow it. If you want to experience for yourself, which the Buddha directed us to do, he said, it's only through your own direct experience that you can achieve real happiness of mind. But we must understand how this Noble Eightfold Path unfolds. And those three factors are most important. They're all important. But those three factors fall into the meditation category. We're practicing effort. We put the effort in to be mindful. When we're mindful of something, deep concentration arises. Now that's Vipassana. A concentration practice of its own accord can be practiced differently. And I'll explain how we do that a little later on. You good with all of this? Yeah? Okay. Any questions so far? Am I going too fast for you? No? We're good? All right. Okay, you'll have questions in a minute. So we want to, what I would like to do is give you one of the concentration techniques, which is also used in Vipassana. And you'll see how they work as a team together. Now, probably the meditation you've been doing, I don't know what you did on your 10-day retreat, for example, but usually you're given one or two, or either or, primary objects to observe. Because to concentrate the mind, we need to be able to focus the mind. We need to be able to observe without distraction a particular object of mind. In the Mahasi practice, Mahasi Sayadaw, for those of you who don't know, Mahasi Sayadaw was extremely famous. He was like a rock star in Burma. He would give a Dharma talk, 10,000 people would turn up. I'm not joking. His name comes from a big drum. You know those big drums you see in the Thai temples, and you know, I love banging those. Do you love banging those? I love it. Just go boom, you know, fantastic, like at Nam Tien or something like that. I want to race up when I'm down at Nam Tien and say, let me ring the bell. And there's a sign, don't touch. And my mind is going, let me ring that bell. So anyway, in Mahasi Sayadaw, his name means, Mahasi means big drum, and Sayadaw means teacher, or it's a little higher than that. It's more like sort of master or professor or something like that. In his home, his home monastery, which is in a place called Sekum, in the north of Burma, which we visited, and there's a massive drum there. And apparently they used, when this Mahasi Sayadaw was giving a Dharma talk, they would ring this bell. And so his reputation grew. And thousands of people would come pouring in from all over to listen to his Dharma talks. And they say that, I'm told with all reliability, that 10,000 people or more would come to listen. Isn't that amazing? Yeah? Yeah, I can't believe it. So big drum Sayadaw. The big drum Sayadaw, his technique, which we'll try a little later on, requires that the yogi, or the practitioner, is called a yogi, is able to focus on a primary object for a period of time until the mind becomes calm, a little tranquil. There's two objects that are used. Mahasi Sayadaw used to like using the rising and falling movement of the abdomen. You place, direct your attention to that area just around the belly button, and you try to watch as you breathe in and breathe out. There's a movement at the abdomen, the diaphragm, and we try to concentrate on that movement. Another technique, which is more commonly used in most traditions in Burma and Thailand, Sri Lanka, is the breath at the nostrils. This is known as anapana meditation in Pali. Anapana, breathing in, breathing out meditation. And you try to concentrate on the breath coming in and coming out. How you observe this coming in and coming out, or what you observe with the breathing coming in and coming out, how you observe it is the difference between concentration and vipassana, and I'll explain that in a minute. The same with the rising and falling of the abdomen. It's how you observe it is whether you get hooked into the concentration or you're able to see with the eyes of vipassana. But initially, what we need to do is focus on the object to stabilize the mind. Right? There's a saying from the Buddha here, I found. why do we need to focus? Because our minds are very distracted. They're very busy, or they're very sleepy, or they're very torporous. The mind is often filled with many hindrances, many roadblocks along the way. We're sitting there observing the primary object. In actual fact, we're sleeping. Or we're thinking about our desires for this and that. We're imagining all kinds of scenarios. Oh, if only I had a beautiful girlfriend, then I'd be happy. Or boyfriend these days. If only I could go surfing for the next 20 years, I'd be really happy. Well, if I had a nice house, you're sitting there trying to meditate, and all these thoughts are coming. It's a hindrance of the mind. The mind's busy wanting. That's a hindrance, isn't it? You're not concentrating on the object. You're thinking. Meditation is not thinking. But we are thinking. Or we're feeling sleepy. Oh, I just have a little nap here. That's very nice. I just go off 20 minutes, that'll be okay. Then I can come back for the rising and falling. Or we become restless. Or we have doubt in our own ability to practice. These kind of things. Or we feel suddenly all these remorseful thoughts come in the mind. Or we feel a bit agitated about something. Or we have ill will and anger and we start thinking about that person that insulted us the other day. And suddenly you're mind is imagining and getting caught up in revenge about something, right? This stops our concentration. So the enemy of concentration is these hindrances that come into the mind. This is why concentration is good, because it helps stabilizes the mind and it helps do away with, or at least temporarily suppress, the hindrances in the mind, so the mind can become peaceful and can focus on what should be focused on. Okay, so that's concentration. It suppresses those hindrances in the mind. So these teachers, they taught two ways of doing it: either the rising and falling of the abdomen, or the in and out breathing of the nostrils. So we're going to try this. Now, which one? What I'd like to suggest here is that you choose one and stay with it. So if you've practiced meditation before, you may have experienced the in and out breathing. Who's done meditation with the in and out breathing? All of you? Oh, then you can do this. Who's done the rising and falling of the abdomen? Anyone done rising and falling of the abdomen? Yes, up the back, Chris has. Very good. A little bit? Piano. I forget what it is in Thai now. Yeah. Alright, so we can make this a night of anapana, in and out breathing. Now, if you're practicing in the Thai tradition, what they would use is a little mantra. And this is concentration. One of the techniques of concentration meditation is using a mantra. And in Thailand, they will breathe in and breathe out. With the in-breath, they will say, Bud. And with the out-breath, they'll say, Ho. Bud, Ho, Bud, Ho. Or you can count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This kind of thing. So you can choose what you want to do. And then I'm going to get you to practice in the way of Vipassana with the anapana. So all you're doing here now is just observing the breath. And you can use buddho if you like. You can use nothing at all as well. Or you can count the breath up to 10. One with the in-breath, 2 with the out-breath, up to 10. Right? And if you lose it, actually, go to 5, because that'll be easier for you. In, out, in, out, in, out, like this. If your mind drifts away, come back to 1 again. You understand? And see how that goes. We were with a Burmese monk once in Buddh Gaya, and he used to do this technique of walking meditation. So we'd walk from the Bodhi tree down to the Buddhist University, which is about 2 kilometres in the single file. And his technique for developing the concentration was to count the steps. And he used the technique of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So you had to see if you could stay on the step for those counts. If you blew it, you had to come back and start again. And he would check you. He'd say, "Where are you at now?" So he would walk along you, beside you, and suddenly you'd hear this voice in your ear, "What number are you on?" "Oh, I don't know, sir. I know I've lost something." "Go back to one," he'd say, right? But it was amazing after a kilometre or so. Oh, suddenly the mind started really getting in there, you know. It could really start to concentrate. And you could get up to 6 before it would fly off into something, you know, lose concentration. I think I got up to 10 once. And he gave me a little smile and I was quite gratified. But then I blew it for the rest of the time. So. That's quite a good technique. You can also use in and out. Just the words in, out, in, out, in, out. Okay, you want to try that? Now, what's important here is that you sit with your back quite erect and straight. No schlumping. We do not want schlumping. This is not good. Because what does schlumping do? Leads to drowsiness. We want to be awake, not drowsy. So where do the hands go? In the lap, right on top of the left, up against the belly. When you're practicing concentration meditation, you want a nice, tight, firm position. How about the head? Head should be quite straight, just a little dip of the chin. What to do with the eyes? Close the eyes. No need to keep the eyes open. You're not looking at anything, you're looking inside at the breaths. So when you feel your feet firmly on the floor, no crossing of the feet. Does? You've got your feet crossed. I'm being the teacher here now. No crossing of the feet. Hand in the lap, right on top of the left, hands touching, thumbs touching. Make sure, try to bring your hands in on the belly a little bit. Don't let them come out, because you'll find that you'll experience a lot of pain in the shoulders. It may feel a little weird to start with, but once you do this for a while, you'll be good. Then I'd just like you to take a couple of very quick, big breaths through the nostrils. Just even a little loudly. Like that. And then relax. You can feel your mind being, your attention being pulled in on the object of meditation, which is the in and out breathing. Now, what we want to do here is follow each breath. Just keep your attention around the nostrils. Follow the breath in, follow the breath out. Using that mental label that I spoke about of buddho, buddho, or in, out, or you can count 1, 2, 3, 4, In actual fact, the word doesn't really matter. It's what you experience there. Can you keep your attention on the breath? And at the moment, when you notice that your attention has gone away, bring it straight back. You've got to use a little bit of willpower here. But we also need to learn to relax with it. We don't want to tense up. It might drive you nuts to begin with. We're going to do this for about 15 minutes to give you time to settle. From time to time, I'll prompt you. So keeping your attention at the nostrils, in, out, bud, ho. It's like you're the guard at the gate, watching who's coming in and going out, not missing a person. Ignore everything else but the breath. Try not to be distracted by outside sounds, smells, just the breath, one after the other. In, out, bud, ho. like to stretch a little bit, please stand up, have 5 minutes break. You need to go to the bathroom. Something like that. I'll ring the bell again, 5 minutes. Then I want to know what happened.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm used to doing this because we need this music on this.
Sorry,
I'm not.
You should give one of these to your lecturers. That'd be pretty cool, eh? That'd be cool. Well, I've forgotten where we are now, so I think we have to go home. I want to give you how did you go then? Could you concentrate with that at all? Were any of you able to experience total absorption of mind? No, I'm so surprised you weren't able to do that. Just talking about vipassana and concentration, meditations, one way of understanding it is that when you practice concentration up to the highest level, it's the complete ignoring of any sense experience. You pay no attention to any of the sense doors, right? All you do, stay with the object of meditation. Do you understand this? At a certain point, the mind moves in on itself, dives into the object of meditation, and you have these very blissful experiences. That's concentration. You get this? Yep. It's like when you're really hooked into Facebook. You're not aware of anything else around you. Totally. The adepts, the people that practice concentration meditation, can sometimes stay in these states for as long as they like. One day, 2 days, 3 days. You can put a pin in them and they won't feel it when they're in the high absorption states of mind. The minds are so tranquil, if you like. Well, even the state, there's 8 jhanic states, what they call 8 jhanic states, 4 form and 4 formless states of mind. So I expect you all to reach the 8th jhana in a short period of time. And you can go around putting pins in each other to see if you're in this state or not. So very refined, very beautiful, very lofty states of mind. But as I said, the Buddha wasn't satisfied. He had realized that when he wasn't in this state, even after staying in it for 2, 3, 4 days, he'd come out, and if there was some condition that arose that he experienced through one of his sense doors, an anger arose or irritation arose or something like that, he was still hooked into the worldly life. Right, so this is why under the Bodhi tree he practiced. What he did, I can't say exactly what the Buddha, I wouldn't presume to say exactly what the Buddha did, but there's one indication with this wonderful story that I really love about the Buddha. Someone asked the Buddha, one of his followers asked the Buddha, how he experienced everyday life. Because of course he wasn't in these absorption states all the time. And they were expecting him to say, well, I just ignore everything. Yeah. But he didn't say that. He said, and this is a really important point here. He said, apparently, my mind is silent, but I'm aware of everything. My mind is silent, but I am aware of everything. Now, do you understand what he meant by this? Just think about it for a moment. My mind is silent, but I'm aware of everything. Seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, thinking, I'm aware of everything, but his mind is silent. This is your koan. Next time I come back in 2 years' time, you can tell me the answer to this. But this is really the essence of the Buddha's teachings. What he was meaning here was that there was no identification with what he was experiencing. There was no grasping or wanting to push away, or no aversion, in other words, to what he was experiencing. His mind was in the middle. His mind was silent. So our minds are not silent, are they? You know, we react to everything constantly, with either likes or dislikes. The Buddha was pointing out here that his mind was silent, but unlike someone that is hooked into concentration, where all the sense doors are ignored, his mind was completely open to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. But because of the wisdom factor, his understanding factor, which is the modus operandi of Vipassana meditation to develop wisdom about actually how things are, his mind was not reacting in the way that we would react to things. It was completely free of attachment or aversion to what it was that he was experiencing. Another story I like is that the Buddha walked past a person that was playing a lute, apparently. And he stopped and listened and said, "Very good." And then his follower said, "Why did you say that to him? Weren't you enjoying that sensual pleasure?" Because often people, Buddhists, will say that we should not enjoy sensual pleasure. But the Buddha wasn't like that. He enjoyed it for that moment, but he moved on. He wasn't, "I want another experience the same as that, or another experience the same as that." He enjoyed that moment, and only that moment, for that moment. And then he moved on. So he let go. So if we can follow that advice, then we're going to be okay. If we crave or have aversion, we want something to last, that is impossible because everything's changing, then we're in trouble. Okay? So you can enjoy the band, you can enjoy the party, but that moment is only that moment. You understand what I mean here? I think this is a crucial teaching of the Buddha, and I love that story. Buddha, in the Buddha's teachings, he was always talking about the middle way between extremes, wasn't he? You know, so this is where we should try and fit ourselves into our life situations with a kind of middle way outlook. So coming back to Vipassana, with that first saying of the Buddha's, "My mind is silent, but I'm aware of everything," this is Vipassana. Vipassana takes account of all the sense doors and all the experiences that we perceive through our sense doors as the objects of meditation. Every time we see something, hear something, taste something, smell something, think something, touch something, we need to be aware of it and see the changing nature of that experience, the impermanence, the anicca of that experience. That's the wisdom factor coming into play. Whereas with concentration meditation, we're ignoring everything. With Vipassana meditation, we're opening up to everything. But we need that initial concentration to stabilize the mind a little bit, so we're not continually caught up in discursive thinking, ruminating, fantasizing, etc., etc. We need to be able to watch with a silent mind. So it's said that the development of vipassana is the development of the great observing mind. The great observing mind. We learn to observe ourselves. Whenever we hear, see, smell, taste, and touch, we experience it. You're watching the breath at the nostrils, right? A sound comes, as it did. We could hear the sounds outside. In vipassana, you would take notice of that. You would note hearing, just that the hearing's happening. In concentration, we would try and ignore it totally. It's like we're using our will to not buy into a sound. But with vipassana, we're trying to open up to that sound and use it for our understanding. When we smell a smell, when we taste a taste, when we experience a touch, we have to be aware of it. That kind of thing. Do you understand this? Now, say for example, I'll just talk just a few minutes more on this because it's important. The in and out breathing. There's two different ways we can experience it. One is for the development of jhana, or absorption states of mind, or these high, lofty, blissful states that I talked about. Or we can observe it with a vipassana mind. Now, vipassana, one way of, for the development of vipassana knowledge, right? Because vipassana is an actual knowledge or intuitive knowledge that arises in the mind. The English translation of it is insight, or insight, understanding, or wisdom that arises in the mind. So we experience vipassana. With concentration meditation, which is known as samatha meditation, we experience samadhi. The state of mind that we experience is called a samadhi state. The state of mind that's experienced with vipassana is called jnana, or vipassana knowledge in the mind. It's like, oh, now I understand. You know, like you're working on a problem in your lectures or something. Suddenly you understand that, right? It's like that. Does that give you a feel for it? And when you go through the process of vipassana over a period of time, a number of insights which are not on the conceptual level arise in the mind. Those insights break the shackles of craving and attachment in the mind. That's the mechanics of it. And that's how it unfolds in the training. Is there some understanding there of what I'm saying? Do you understand this a little bit? Okay. So coming back to the in and out breathing, for example. When we're practicing for samadhi, we're doing our samatha practice, concentration practice, to experience samadhi, this state. We just observe the breath. Buddho, buddho, in, out, in, out. If we're practicing with the if we're practicing it in a vipassana way, we don't actually observe the breath. We observe the touch sensation of the breath on the upper lip. Right, so when you breathe in and breathe out, you'll notice that there is, inside the nostrils or on the upper lip, there's a feeling, a sensation that arises. For example, that sensation, let me give you a feel for that. Put your hand up like this. Now, keep watching the hand. Put your attention right in the middle of the hand there. Don't look at me, just look at the, feel the hand. In the beginning you won't feel very much, but just keep your hand there. Keep your attention on it. And try not to move the hand. Just feel it. And what does it feel like? And you feel the sensation. You might feel heavy, light, pressure, tingling. Concentrate on it. Know it. Your perception becomes clearer about what hand actually is. It's made up of various components, various elements, hardness, softness, heat, cold, movement. Can you feel that? Does it feel a little different now? Okay, you can put your hand down. It might have hurt a little bit. You might have felt hot or cold. So when you're observing that the nostrils, what you observe is the air touching the walls of the nostrils or the upper lip. So it's that touch sensation that you're looking for. What happens then is that you're now moving away from just a conceptual level of things into a reality level of things. You're seeing things actually as they are. If you didn't hold your hand, your attention on your hand, you would think, oh, the hand is just the hand. But when you start to look at it, you start to feel, oh, that's not exactly the hand. That's made up of different elements, hot, cold, pressure, tingling, hardness, softness, etc., etc. We start to get a feel for what it is. The same with in and out breathing. It's probably not so clear for you, but when you practice a little more, you'll get an understanding of this. So what I'd like to do to finish off tonight is to do that exercise again, but not just to watch your breath coming in and out. I want you to see if you can see where the breath touches the upper lip or the inside of the nostrils. It means you've got to look quite closely to try and feel it. You can still use in and out or buddho, but you want to experience it more fully, like this. You think you can do that? Let's have a go and see if we can do that. We might just, could you bring the lights down just a bit? Now, once again, what's required here is some alertness. So you might be feeling a little weary at the moment, a little tired, but watch that attitude. Change that attitude. You try to bring an energy in, so by straightening the back a bit, don't let the head droop. Put your hands in the lap, as I mentioned before, up against the belly. Straighten the legs. To practice meditation is not easy. All these masters, they're all very vigorous in their practice. Remember, the Noble Eightfold Path consists of effort, mindfulness, being out the ability to pay attention, to know what's happening, and to penetrate what's happening with our concentration. You can take one or two deep breaths to begin with. That often helps with quietening the mind. And then just bringing the mind to an even keel, relaxing the mind. We're not trying to achieve anything. We're not trying to push anything away. We're not trying to get anything. In Vipassana meditation, we're just observing what is. Just observing what is in the present moment, without judgment, without a view or opinion. We're relaxing and watching. We're watching the breath, and we're watching the touch of the breath on the upper lip or inside, just inside the nostrils. In other words, we're feeling the breath. If our mind drifts away, we know that. Oh, it's drifted away, we notice it. Vipassana is about noticing what's happening to us. Suddenly we become aware of a sound. With Vipassana we'll know that. We can make a mental note of it, hearing, hearing, hearing. And then come back to the primary object again. After a while we may feel or perceive some other sensation somewhere in the body. We might feel hot or cold, tingling, achy, painful, tight, stiff. In Vipassana, if it becomes obvious for us in some place in the body, we shift our attention from the nostrils and observe that sensation. Stiffness, stiffness, tightness, tightness. See how it behaves for us. One moment there might be a sensation in the shoulder of achiness. Suddenly you perceive something else in the leg, or the arms, or the hands. You might experience a tingling in the face. These can be noted and known. Nothing obvious, just stay with the breath. Nothing more obvious, stay with the breath. It's like we're opening up and looking at the cinema. With a bare attention, non-judgmental attention. Just watching, as if we were watching a movie. Everything that's going on for us. Sometimes a thought will come in, or an emotion will come in. We can watch that as well. Oh, there's a happy thought, there's a ill will thought. We can watch that. There's a worried thought, an anxious thought. We can watch that. Or another sensation may appear somewhere in the body. We can move our attention to that area. Painful, painful, achy, achy. Maybe nothing happening, just come back to the primary object again. In and out, in and out. I feel bored with it all, we can watch boredom. I feel restless, we can watch restless. Be mindful of the present moment experience is what we need to learn to do. with vipassana. Concentration meditation, we're suppressing things temporarily. With vipassana, we're opening up to life itself by observing our experience in the present moment, getting to know our mind is the most important thing we can do. First verse in the Dhammapada goes like this. The mind is the leader. The mind is the dominant one. All things are made by the mind. If one should speak or act with an unskilled mind, the suffering caused by that follows him or her as the wheel of the cart does an ox's hoof. This is the first verse given by the Buddha in the Dhammapada. The mind is all important. Get to know the mind. Free the mind from defilements. This is the teaching of the Buddha. Thank you for listening.
Does anyone have any question you'd like to ask?
Yes.
Grant, would you say that the difference between the two practices is that in one you just have a primary object, whereas in vipassana you have a primary and secondary objects?
Not quite, Chris. It depends on the tradition, really. Now, because in the Mahasi tradition, the difference between the practice taught by Mahasi was that Mahasi thought that in the old days they thought that one had to achieve jhana before doing vipassana and then switching to vipassana. But Mahasi found in his own practice that you only needed, and not only needed, it's still quite a high level of concentration called upachara samadhi, which is a little higher than normal samadhi. But he said it wasn't necessary to reach jhana. And so there was some discussion amongst his peers about this, some disagreement. But Mahasi stuck to his guns and showed, proved that it wasn't necessary. Now, as far as primary and secondary objects goes, that's just in the beginning. Every object becomes a primary object. Really what one should say is that please watch the most obvious object, the most dominant object. So in Mahasi's instructions, right in the beginning of practice, he uses the phrase to observe the six sense doors. And then he goes on to say, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, if we can observe the six sense doors, we can gain wisdom. Every time we hear something, smell something, taste something, come in contact with something, we need to observe it. But he said, because the mind is not well trained, it's too fragmented to be able to stay on the object to observe it. he likens it to a cork bobbing on a lake. You may have heard this before. And if the mind is superficial and just stays on top of the lake like a cork, it's not going to be able to see anything. Our minds need to be like a stone that sinks to the bottom of the experience. They call it penetrating the experience, like this. So primary and secondary objects are just it's not actually real. It's just to give you a feel for the beginning instructions, the basic instructions. But once you've got stability and the awareness is stronger as the practice matures, then every object. You can see arising and falling in seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, whatever, thinking. Yep. Is that clear? Yep, thank you. Good question. Yeah.
During meditation, if you experience a lot of aches, pain, tightness, even randomly throughout my daily life,
I recommend that you just take a moment and watch that. Watch the pain. And also what you can watch is how your mind's reacting to that pain. It's really quite amazing. If you can just be still within the pain, it'll change quickly. As soon as you start identifying and reacting to it, then your mind will be in turmoil. So when the mind is okay with the pain, like if it's some kind of medical condition and the pain's there, but your mind's not in pain. You understand what I mean? So it's just in the observance of the painful experience. It may take a little practice, but say you're sitting in a chair and suddenly you start to feel a lot of pain in the chair, in your body or something like that because you've been sitting too long, But instead of moving straight away, just watch the pain for a moment longer and see what happens over a month period. You could take that as your meditation object. We mentioned in the profile, if you like, I learned this on the cushion, off the cushion method. And it's a matter of just observing what's happening to you in your daily life, whether you're sitting, standing, bending, stretching, whatever's coming up for you. You can watch the physical sensation, you can watch the mood of the mind. All of these things can be observed. And over a period of time, you will notice a real change in how you identify or not identify with the experience. It's just an experience. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you've just got to try. One thing you can do with this is this Vipassana meditation is a combination of the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, whether they're pleasant, unpleasant or neutral. Mindfulness of the mind itself, meaning the mental states that are arising in the mind. And mindfulness of the six sense doors. So what I like to do is I take like one of them. And I like all of them. Right, it's practice, right? But I like the body. Now here it means the activities of the body. It means knowing what posture you're in. So you go into the classroom and you go, not another class, mind gets... You just be aware of the posture. I'm sitting. Simple as that, I'm sitting. I get up, I'm getting up. I'm walking down to the restaurant, I'm walking. I'm sitting down at the restaurant, I'm sitting. You're keeping your mind in the present moment instead of letting it drift off all over the place. These are all little concentration things that lead to insight. This is where concentration and mindfulness combine together. So I use it a lot, especially walking. When we do intensive meditation retreats, there's equal periods of sitting and walking meditation. And so I use it a lot. If I'm walking downtown, I've got to go to a meeting, and, you know, mind's getting a little anxious, I'm not, getting anxious, right? Then I just tune into the feet, walking, left, right, something like this. And suddenly you're right in there. Then you start to feel the sensation in the feet, you know, heaviness, lightness, like the hand going up and down. And it's really good. You know, you hear a sound, and usually react with, I don't like that sound, or I love that sound. You know, it's like you're more in the middle. You know, that's okay. You know, you're okay if you can observe with equanimity. You're okay. Yeah, and that's the point. Yeah. Okay, you good with that? Mm-hmm. All right, okay, good. I think we should stop here. I have to be equanimous and drive to Wollongong, so it's enough already. Yeah. I've enjoyed being with you tonight.